I'm here with Alan J. Lichtman, whose latest book is The Embattled Vote in America, From the Founding to the Present. Alan, thanks for being here with us today.
My great pleasure.
So I want to talk about the book, of course, and maybe some of the issues that you raise in it. Let me begin the conversation by asking you this. More than 200 years after America's founding, there's still a battle over voting rights because, as you write, the framers made a consequential mistake when they drafted the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. What was that mistake? And generally speaking, how has it played out over the course of the country's history?
It is indeed the consequential mistake of the framers. Understand, the framers were all men. They were mostly substantial men, slaveholders, people with commercial interests, speculators, lawyers. And they believed that only those who had real standing in society should have the right to vote, notably property holders, or to some extent, those who paid taxes. And the big debate in the Constitutional Convention was not whether there should be a right to vote, which they did not believe should be broadly extended to the American people. The big debate was over whether or not they should include economic qualifications in the Constitution. And they decided not to, not out of principle, but out of practice. They did not want to override the rights of the states to set their own economic qualifications because they knew that for the new Constitution to go into effect, it had to be ratified by at least 3/4 of the states, and they were hoping for all of the states. So they defaulted voting rights to the states, and that is true to this day. All subsequent amendments on voting to the Constitution have been framed negatively in terms of what the states can't do. You can't deny the right to vote based on race or sex or age of 18 years or over. But none of these amendments confer a positive right to vote. And that's why I say the vote has been embattled in America from the founding to the present. People have been struggling for the right to vote, and they don't have a resort to the United States Constitution. And the achievement of voting rights in America has not been a smooth and linear process. Voting rights have both been expanded and contracted, and they remain contested today. In fact, we are at a pivot point when it comes to voting rights in America.
You understand what you're saying there, and I do want to return to where we are at the present time, especially here just a month or so after the midterms. But near the beginning of your book, you have a great quote, and I'll read it. "The founders may have loved the common people, but not well enough to entrust them with control over government." I think that people a little familiar with American history may know this or suspect this or have a sense of this, but talk a little bit about what informed the founders and what might have motivated them philosophically and pragmatically. Why did they not trust the common people enough?
Well, America was, of course, founded on what was a very radical principle for the late 18th century, and that is the sovereignty of the people. Government would be based on the people, not on the divine right of kings or the right of conquest. And that was an extraordinary founding idea. However, the founders tempered that idea with their fear that the people would be swayed by unscrupulous demagogues, and those demagogues could get the people to act against their best interests and against the freedoms and liberties of the American people and the stability of the early republic. That's why they believed in economic qualifications for voting. And that's why the only office in the original Constitution, national office, that was directly elected by the people was the House of Representatives. They called it the People's House. The Senate was elected by state legislatures, and that didn't change until the early 20th century. And of course, to this day, there is no popular vote for president, but rather presidents are elected by the College of Electors selected in each individual state.
In your chapter, constructing and deconstructing the vote, you look at the post-Civil War dynamic of extending the franchise to and withholding it from newly freed slaves. Now, I know this could be a pretty broad question, but I'm wondering if you could speak to some of the key moments in this period, also looking at how the issue played out, not just in former Confederate states, but also in the North.
Yes, certainly a key moment was in the late 1860s, when the Congress of the United States was debating what became the 15th Amendment. As I mentioned, the 15th Amendment is phrased negatively, that the states cannot deny the right to vote based on race, color, or condition of previous servitude. But there was a major debate within the Congress over whether they should establish an affirmative right to vote. And that was resolutely rejected by the great majority of members of the Congress. And they were worried if you established a universal right to vote, my goodness, paupers could vote. Maybe even Native Americans could vote. And God forbid, even women could vote. Remember, no women were voting in America at this time. They also worried that because the amendment only focused on race, color, and condition of previous servitude, that the states could get around this amendment by adopting measures that on their face were not racial, but had the effect of denying the right to vote to African Americans and other minorities, such as mechanisms like literacy tests and poll taxes. But again, restrictions on those measures were rejected by the Congress because they believed that that was again going too far and could not be ratified by the states. They felt the sacrifices of the Civil War, you know, hundreds of thousands of dead, the South devastated, justified voting rights for the newly freed slaves, but nothing more. And that, of course, led to the virtual extinguishment of African-American voting rights after the end of Reconstruction in the 1870s and 1880s and the so-called redemption of the South by white supremacists. By the late 19th and early 20th century, Black voting had been almost entirely erased in the South through mechanisms like the literacy test, the poll tax, the grandfather clause. But limitations on minority voting and voting by the less affluent were not limited to the South. There were quite a number of states in the North as well that had literacy tests. And states North and South in the late 19th and early 20th century adopted personal registration requirements, which made it more difficult, particularly for people at the margins of society, to vote. So you had the great irony, particularly when it came to Black voting. At the very beginning of the Republic, most states did not prohibit African Americans from voting. They didn't have white-only clauses in their constitution. That changed in the early pre-Civil War 19th century, when America moved towards a white man's republic and virtually all states extinguished African American voting. The voting was supposedly restored with the 15th Amendment, then it was snuffed out again with the redemption of the South.
You briefly mentioned women's suffrage in your comments there for a moment, and the story of women's suffrage is also a long and winding one, and race played in that time significant role there too. Can you talk about this aspect of voting history? And there was something interesting to me, at least in your book, about the state of New Jersey in particular, and how over the decades it alternately extended and then withdrew the right of women to vote.
That's right. New Jersey was the one state of the Union that at the beginning of the Republic authorized voting by women, and there weren't many of them, who could meet the state's economic requirements. But as the nation moved to the ideology of the white man's republic, New Jersey extinguished women's voting rights around 1807. And this ideology of the white man's republic pretty much led to the elimination of economic qualifications, but the establishment and continuation of qualifications based on race and sex. In other words, what were believed to be the inherent aspects of people came to replace external possessions like property. And both African Americans and women in the 19th century were kind of jumbled together in the same category of people who did not have the inherent qualifications and ability to vote. Women weren't strong enough. They weren't independent enough. African Americans were too ignorant, did not have the same mental capacities as whites. And ironically, and this is so important in linking the past to the present, the denial of the right to vote to both women and African Americans was justified on the basis of voter fraud. African American votes would be bought. Women, their votes would be manipulated because they were weak and dependent. Of course, there was no evidence to this effect, just as there's no evidence today of any significant voter fraud. But those were justifications for denying the vote for African Americans and women. And it took women a very long struggle. We didn't get the 19th Amendment to the Constitution until 1920. And unfortunately, even within the movement for suffrage, the issue of race very much divided the women pushing for women's rights. And some of the predominantly white women in the suffrage movement used their own type of racist arguments to get women the right to vote, saying, look, you know, if these ignorant immigrants or black people can vote, surely you can't deny the vote to refined, educated white women. You know, you cannot separate, unfortunately, voting rights in America from race in America, of course, like so much else in our history.
You know, I do want to come up to the present day. I want to talk about the effects of the 2013 Supreme Court decision, this Shelby decision that invalidated preclearance provisions of the Voting Rights Act. How has this influenced efforts like gerrymandering and packing of minority districts and other mechanisms that, you know, have the effect, of, I guess, of suppressing the vote?
Yes, as I've argued, if you look at the broad sweep of American history, voting rights have both been expanded and contracted. And the Shelby decision certainly has contributed to the contraction of voting rights in our own time. This decision essentially wiped out Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which said that states and localities with a history of voting discrimination had to pre-clear any changes in voting laws and regulations with the United States Department of Justice, or alternatively, go to the DC federal courts and prove that these changes were not discriminatory. Over 1,000 discriminatory changes were blocked as a result of Section 5. And most of the covered jurisdictions were in the South, places like Georgia, South Carolina, Texas. With the striking down by the Supreme Court of Section 5, then jurisdictions could go ahead and make any changes they want in voting laws and regulation without preclearance. The only way to stop it was to launch a lawsuit. And as you know, voting rights lawsuits are expensive, they're hard to win, they take protracted amounts of time. And this decision kind of has given many states license to adopt restrictive voting measures like, as you point out, racial gerrymandering, stringent photo voter identification requirements that limit the right to vote of people on the margins of societies, draconian purges of voter rolls as the kind we see in Georgia, or this exact match law that they have in Georgia, which says, you know, if your name is misspelled by one letter, or you put in your middle initial rather than your middle name, or you leave out a hyphen, your voting registration records don't count. Or what we saw in North Dakota, a new law which says your ID had to have an exact address on it, targeted against Native Americans who live on reservations where they don't have those kinds of addresses. So, and poll closings, closing many polls, so make it more difficult for marginal people to get access to the polls. All of these changes likely would have been blocked under Section 5, but it no longer exists.
Alan, does you said poll closings, but what about poll relocations too? You know, we've seen some of that in recent years as well. Would that been covered by the preclearance?
Absolutely. Any poll closing, any relocation of a poll, you would have had to preclear it. It doesn't mean preclearance doesn't mean it has to be a big major law like a statewide voting photo ID law. It could be something done by local jurisdictions within covered states as well.
You mentioned, you know, the excuse of voter fraud to make it more difficult to vote and to suppress turnout. We see continued attempts to do that right up through the most recent midterm elections, and with typically Republican officials citing voter fraud as justification. Now, I think most people, I could be wrong, but it seems like most people understand that statistics don't bear out the notion of widespread fraud. But isn't there a danger in simply repeating this charge over and over?
There is great danger. You know, people come to believe things that they hear over and over. It's, you know, the classic technique of dictators. It's called the big lie. And the big lie works, particularly when it's perpetrated by the president of the United States, who's issued the biggest lie yet on voter fraud, claiming that somehow 3 to 5 million illegal voters mysteriously appeared on election day, all voted for Hillary Clinton, and mysteriously disappeared. This would be the greatest conspiracy in the history of the country. Not only did the president present this without evidence, but all of the evidence completely contradicts it. Their voter fraud was vanishingly small in the presidential election of 2016, just as it has been in virtually all modern elections. Study after study after study has documented that you're about as likely to be hit by lightning as someone is to commit voter fraud. Even the Republican National Law Association, which set out to try to prove widespread voter fraud to justify these Republican measures like photo ID laws and draconian purges of registration rolls. And looking at a 15-year period, they only came up with a few hundred cases of voter fraud out of many hundreds of millions of ballots cast. I was involved in the big lawsuit against the voter restrictions that have been passed by the state of North Carolina in 2013. And they did a big study over a long period of time to try to uncover voter impersonation at the polls to justify their photo voter ID law. And they came up with precisely two. Wisconsin and Pennsylvania in their lawsuit couldn't come up with any. So indeed, as a famous book by Professor Manette is entitled, The Myth of Voter Fraud. It's a myth, but it's perpetrated and people come to believe it. Now, why are Republicans doing this? For the simple reason that their base is the most shrinking part of the electorate, older white voters. And the Democratic base is minority voters to a great extent. So the Republicans can't manufacture more elderly white men, but they can attempt to restrict the rising base of the Democratic Party. Hard politics, as always, throughout our history, underlies this.
So your book appeared before the 2018 midterms. You raise a number of concerns that I think the 2018 midterms helped answer in some ways. What, if anything, did you see in this most recent cycle that both gives you cause for hope and cause for concern? Florida voters approved a measure to restore the franchise to felons who have served their sentences. But in places, say, like Georgia, there were what seemed like, you know, legitimate possibilities in charges of voter suppression.
Yes. There was both hope and despair in this most recent election. You know, ironically, Florida, which has been seeing so much electoral controversy, has pioneered two very important things that I really want to stress because they could change the whole landscape of voter participation in America. You mentioned, of course, the referendum re-enfranchising former felons, those who have paid their debt to society. And by the way, the disenfranchisement of felons is, of course, very much tied to race. It was one of the techniques that was used in the Jim Crow South to limit the voting of African Americans, who are often targeted, of course, by law enforcement. The other thing that Florida did, though, that's even more important because it's more general. Earlier on, they had passed an anti-gerrymandering referendum. And before that, the Florida congressional seats had been badly gerrymandered, even though it's a swing state. Most congressional seats had gone to Republicans. After this election and the anti-gerrymandering amendment, it was virtually tied. I think it was 14 Republicans, 13 Democrats, about where it should be. And the lesson is they bypassed the legislature, which would never have contemplated, obviously, an anti-gerrymandering amendment. So the model for the states is, if you want to establish laws that open up voting and stop voter suppression, go around the state legislatures and do it by referendum. Get grassroots movements going to stop things like some of the despairing things we saw in the 2018 election, the suspension of 1,000 registrations in Georgia by the Secretary of State, who was also the Republican candidate for governor, on the grounds, you know, that there wasn't an exact match, or the requirement that you present proof of address in North Dakota. So there were some pretty troubling, and poll closings. So there was some pretty troubling signs in this election. Another positive sign just before this election was that the Supreme Court of the state of Pennsylvania struck down its gerrymandering of congressional districts. That gerrymandering had given Republicans more than 70% control of seats after the 2010 census, even though they won only 49% of the congressional vote. This was struck down not by the federal courts, but by the state Supreme Court, and now there's a fair plan in Pennsylvania. So another model is, maybe you shouldn't be going to the federal courts where there isn't a constitutional guarantee of the vote, but a more promising path for voting rights might well be the state courts.
So now, looking at all of this, what kind of reforms would you hope to see? You know, obviously, I think a lot of people think about the Electoral College, but there's also motor voter registration or maybe requiring a national voting holiday. So that's one topic, the reforms. And then I'll ask you to maybe give your thoughts or predictions about the likelihood that there will ever be a right to vote amendment.
First, anti-gerrymandering amendments to the state constitution modeled on the one that passed in Florida. If it can pass in Florida, it could pass in states all over the country. Secondly, same-day registration. Allow people to register on the day in which they vote. That's been proven to substantially increase turnout, again, particularly of marginal people. Third, some type of automatic registration. Oregon pioneered this. When you go to get a driver's license or renew your driver's license, you're automatically registered to vote unless you fill out an opt-out form. That substantially upped registration and turnout in the state of Oregon. And of course, you know, these are just dreams, much, much harder to enact, popular voting for the president of the United States. We've now seen twice in the last 16 years the popular vote contradict the Electoral College vote. Electoral College is a relic of the 18th century and, of course, should be changed. Ultimately, I would love to see a right to vote enshrined in the Constitution, but there doesn't seem to be any appetite for that among Republicans. And, of course, a constitutional amendment requires two-thirds of both houses of Congress to pass it and three-quarters of the states to ratify it. There isn't even an indication among Republicans that they're interested in bills that would repair the Shelby decision and restore preclearance on a basis of where the states stand today in terms of voting rights. But I do think state-by-state reforms for things like automatic registration and same-day registration and anti-gerrymandering are very possible. But as in Florida, with the anti-gerrymandering amendment, you've got to build grassroots momentum.
Alan, this conversation has been fascinating. I really want to recommend your book to listeners. The book is The Embattled Vote in America, From the Founding to the Present by Alan J. Lichtman. Alan, I think we've really barely scratched the surface here, but I want to thank you for your time. This has been a great conversation.
Thank you. We could do a whole, semester's worth of class on what we've been talking about.